Hello, I'm Kenny Pasenik-Linden with Radio Free Palmer, and joining me in the studio today is Joe Miller. Mr. Miller is running for the U.S. Senate as a Republican. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Miller.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we have four questions relating to the general theme of how do you work with others today? And just a bit of background, both nationally and here in Alaska, there seems to have developed a more than usual political polarization, resulting in gridlock and decisions made by use of power that isn't always backed by a majority of citizens. So diving right into our first question, how do you view the present state of government and how do you work with others of different perspectives, both within and without your party?
Well, I think that, first of all, the most important allegiance that you have is to the people. And that's over anybody else, any other party, any type of partisan wrangling that might be taking place. And my commitment to the people of Alaska, if they choose to elect me, is that I will put their interests first before any other. Now, sometimes that means that you agree with your party. Sometimes that means you agree with the other party. But frankly, what we see today in Washington, D.C., and the problems that we have at government is primarily a consequence, I believe, of compromise and moving government too rapidly forward, expanding it. I mean, when we look at the debt, we're sitting at $17.5 trillion in absolute debt, $200 trillion in future unfunded liabilities. It took a whole lot of bipartisanship to create that level of debt. That's a paraphrase of Senator Ted Cruz. Very frequently, when government gets power, it wants to keep it. You can see a bureaucratic state that has expanded for pretty much every year over the last three decades. The interesting thing is my party, the Republican Party, is a party of small government, and yet each year it's expanded. 30 of the last 34 years, Republicans have controlled the House, the Senate, and or the presidency, and yet government has continued to expand. Look at, for example, the Bush administration, the largest expanse of the federal government in history. Of course, under the Obama administration, even more so. And so, you know, that's a result of actually doing too much at the federal level. I'm the type of guy that says that we at the local level, at the state level, should have more control. The one-size-fits-all that Washington establishes is not what was intended by the Constitution, and it's not what's going to move this country forward, especially as it becomes more diverse. At the state level, we're able to do those things that the people believe is more important to their livelihood, more important to their interests, more important to their values. And as a result, that's my commitment, is that I'll do anything I can with any party, with any member of my own party, to bring power back to the state.
Do you have any specific examples of how you've worked across party lines in a nonpartisan way?
If you look at, for example, the history over this last, of course, most people are familiar with what happened in 2010. My efforts in 2010 were to take on the establishment. In many cases, members of my own party. Some of the positions that I've taken have been positions that have been embraced by the left. Many of the federal libertarian positions that I take are positions embraced by the left. And I saw earlier that we're going to talk about some of those issues, such as the surveillance state. Obviously, federal control at any level is something that somebody that embraces the Bill of Rights is going to say, this is my objective. This is what I want to do. When I advocate for those positions, which are an expansion of individual liberty, it's something that very frequently is a value that's held by those on the left, not on the right. Now, there are some within the Republican Party. There's a loyal opposition in the Republican Party that does have those interests. I mean, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Rand Paul, to a certain extent, they have elevated those to important levels such that they will, you know, talk about that, and filibuster about that, emphasize that in their daily political discourse. But as far as some of these other issues, like, for example, life, I'm very pro-life. That tends to be a value that's held primarily on the Republican side, although Republicans haven't done a very good job in protecting it. The fact is that's something that there are very few people on the other side of the aisle that they share that, and that's an uncompromising value for me.
When you say that's an uncompromising value for you, how would you draw in people of different perspectives and of different beliefs, how would you pull something together or work with other politicians to really be able to represent the people? Because you said at the beginning that you are a person
right,
of the people, not necessarily of a party.
And I think that we've already seen that. I mean, at the your age group, for example, and I'm not to presume to know what your age is, but you're a lot younger than I. And when we see what's happening in the polling, with respect to the perspectives on life. There are major inroads that have been made because of people communicating the value of life and making the case that, look, if you have a society that does not protect the most defenseless, you do not have a society that's going
to
protect the rights
of
others.
According to the Guttmacher Institute, the most local polling or most recent polling has said that 70% of Americans support equal access to abortion in their area. That's a majority of Americans.
You know, polling is done in so many different ways to achieve so many different results. And I will tell you the most reliable polling shows that a majority of Americans are pro-life and that the group of pro-life Americans, that youth, is expanding as well. So, you know, I don't know, you know, whether they've got a bone in the fight or not as far as what kind of results they want in polling. But we've learned a long time ago that polling doesn't necessarily reflect, at least depending on who you are and what your agency's objective is, the reality of the American people. Let me give you one example.
Can I
give you an example now?
Well, yes, but going back to how do you represent what the beliefs are of the American people without something like polling? How do you actually find out what the majority of Americans are thinking if polling isn't useful?
Well, I'm not saying polling's not useful. If it's honest polling, it is. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we as a political figure do internal polling. You know, back in the 2010 race, everybody said Miller's going to lose 37 points down a few weeks before the primary election, and we won. You know, what happened with the Brandt-Cantor race? Bratt was shown, this is the majority leader of Virginia, Bratt was shown down 32 points the Friday before the election. He won by 11. That's a 43-point spread. You know, that reflects that the polling, particularly in his race, was designed to do something, achieve a different result. And that's what happens all the time. Our internal polling, for example, in this race shows that all the candidates, Republican candidates, are within single digits of each other. There are 40-some
plus.
Are
you referring to the Alaska U.S. Senate race?
And yet you can pick your poll out there in the public, and it's going to show, oh, Miller doesn't have a chance. That's not the reality of it. And so, you know, when we go out there and we try to find out what the American people think, don't confuse me. On the subject of life, this is not an opinion poll. I'm just making the point that we can, as leaders, convince those, I think, on values that the Constitution protects that we need to pursue that. And so not always is it putting your finger in the air and seeing where the wind blows. With respect to life, I mean, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, it embraces the sanctity of life. I mean, the whole idea, the concept of individual liberty is based upon the protection of the individual. In a society that says that the most defenseless can be sacrificed, it's going to be willing to sacrifice any right of anyone, especially those that aren't defenseless. So my perspective of it is that we have a role to play in advocating for those values of the Constitution. It's something that I aggressively will do, and it's an uncompromising value for me, the protection, the unequivocal protection of innocent life.
All right. Moving on to our second question, and this one's coming back to specifically Alaska. And here in Alaska, there's been considerable focus on balancing both resource development of extractive industries with environmental concerns. What are your guiding principles when weighing in on this topic?
Well, I think that, first of all, most people that came to Alaska, including me, I've been here over 20 years. I came here because of the beauty of the state. I mean, it's an extraordinary place. I love to hunt. I love to fish. I love the outdoors. When I have time, what little time I have, I go outside and I enjoy what God has blessed us with in the state. I don't think anybody in the state, and hopefully nobody that's involved in the extractive industries, looks at things any differently. But the guiding principle is, of course, we do no harm, and we want development in the state to be safe and responsible. That being said, as I mentioned before, I'm a federal libertarian. I think the feds are involved in far too much. The 10th Amendment of the Constitution reserves those rights that are not specifically enumerated to the federal government, to the states. The 9th and 10th Amendments reserves all those excess powers to the states and the people. 10th Amendment specifically reserves to the states a lot of powers that the federal government has taken on. The EPA is a good example of that. The Environmental Protection Agency is doing things that I don't believe the founders ever would have intended that agency to do. I think the founders intended the states to be largely in charge.
What are you referring to with the EPA in the sense of what they're doing that the Constitution wouldn't have?
Well, I mean, I think the waters are a good example. I mean, we're basically the Environmental Protection Agency, and let me just kind of back up to some history from my perspective. I've been involved with litigation against the Corps of Engineers on the Clean Water Act. We had a case up in Fairbanks where we dealt with the Environmental Protection Agency's assertion of jurisdiction over lands with permafrost. And basically, the argument, I'll just briefly do it, it was fairly complicated, was that in permafrost areas because there were indicators of wetlands by vegetation, the federal government said that they had jurisdiction to determine whether somebody built a house on that land. I mean, it didn't matter whether the land was miles away from a river, miles away from a lake, miles away from anything. It was permafrost, and because it was permafrost and they found an indicator of wetland, in other words, a plant, didn't have to be standing water, the federal government said that they can control whether or not somebody that bought that lot to build a house could actually build the house. There is absolutely no reasonable interpretation of what the founders intended in the Constitution that would give rise to that level of power and control. And this is what's been going on for the last several decades. And it's because you have a Supreme Court that really doesn't care much about what the original intent of the Constitution was. Instead, what the Supreme Court has done consistently over the last several decades is find ways to expand the power of the federal government. And they've done violence to the language of the Constitution. A good example, and you know, a lot of this is a linkage that when people first hear, they say, what in the world are you talking about? But just bear with me. Roe v. Wade, probably one of the worst reasoned decisions at the Supreme Court level, created a right out of what the Supreme Court called a penumbra. And even those on the left, like my constitutional law professor at Yale Law School a number of years ago said, it was one of the worst written, illogic decisions out there. Of course, now it's given rise, at least for, again, a minority of people to this right that they believe that, you know, is a major issue of federal law.
I had a law professor that also said that it was a protected constitutional right and a human right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about Akil Amar, and he's considered to be one of the leading scholars on this. And I don't think much about scholars. I'm just making a comment. This is a guy on the left that's saying it's a very poorly reasoned decision. I think anybody that honestly looks at that decision, anybody that honestly looks at it, not with a political bias.
Based on privacy.
No, based upon the fact that you're creating a right that was never there to start with in the Constitution. And the problem, this is the problem. It's, you know, the state can do what a state may will in many areas that the federal government has basically preempted the states in, okay? At the federal level, though, when you're sitting back and saying that the Constitution doesn't mean what it says, that we're going to create these laws, we can also, of course, then create other things, and we can limit other things. If we don't take a fair reading of the Constitution and say it means what the founders intended, then the meaning of the Constitution is always established by those in the black robes. It's called the tyranny of the judiciary. Basically, the judiciary says,
how does
we
that
don't
come
care.
Back to when it comes to that balance between resource development as well as environmental concerns?
Right, so we're
because that's something that here in the state is such
absolutely.
An important issue.
And we're talking about the EPA, and we're talking about its overexpansive power. And the way that the EPA is able to go out into a state like Alaska, miles away from a river, miles away from a lake, and go to a land that has permafrost on it and say, we have jurisdiction, is because of a very expansive reading of the Constitution. There are many different things that have been used. I mean, whether it be the Commerce Clause, where basically there's a suggestion that, you know, if there's even a microscopic impact on something in the chain of commerce, therefore the federal government has the right to intervene. I mean, there's nothing that one does that you couldn't say then that the federal government has jurisdiction over. Our discussion right now on the airways, we're affecting in some way that people decide how they're going to act. Maybe that's going to impact the way they spend money. The federal government could. I mean, again, this is a ridiculous, you know, very extended argument, but the federal government could try to assert jurisdiction under the same sort of concepts that have led to this expansion of power. I think what we have to do is a fair reading. I mean, the Constitution was established primarily to protect the rights God gave us and to ensure that the federal government couldn't take them. But the whole the conscious approach to the Constitution of many of the folk that drafted it was that the central government is a power that can lead toward tyranny. It's something that most of the people in our country fled from. They fled for religious freedom, other issues, primarily religious freedom, but they saw countries in Europe that were expansive and all-powerful, and the individual did not have rights. And so they wanted to make sure that those individual rights, God-given rights, were protected, and that the federal government, the central government, would not later intrude on them. And so the documents
as a senator, how would you balance that? So it sounds like you're not a supporter of the EPA. So without the EPA, how would we protect our waterways? How would we protect our resources? How would you do that in a way that protects these industries as well as balancing it with the economic growth part?
So government needs to be restricted. That's what the founders thought.
Are you talking about federal government or state government?
The federal government.
Okay.
And so they put in the 10th Amendment that said, hey, if we have not enumerated these powers, Article 1, Section 8 listed 18 enumerated powers. If the federal government isn't given any, if there's a power outside of those 18, the state has it. And so the states are what the founders intended to protect those interests. And one of the exciting things about it is that here in Alaska, like I said, I think if you poll people on the street, they don't want to see the state polluted. They don't want to see harm done to the beautiful environment that we have. They want to enjoy it. That's in part why almost all of us are here. And we are the people that have the ability to control government at the state level in such a way that we can make sure that those interests are preserved. The federal government was not intended to expand so that, for example, again, my lot up in Fairbanks, I can't build without permission of the federal government. Local, you know, I'm a libertarian at many different levels, but at the federal level, the feds should not be into it. The state can then decide at a lower level as to what type of protections are in place. But again, the state, I think, is in a much better position. We live here. We enjoy it here. This is why we've chosen to raise our families here. Why not us be in charge rather than Washington, D.C., thousands of miles away, that really, frankly, is impacted by crony capitalism and other things that many times ensures that the people's interests aren't reflected.
All right. Go ahead. We're moving on to our third question. And we've talked about this a little bit already. And this is a two-part question. Edward J. Snowden's actions have led to a widespread discussion about another balance, this one being between privacy and security. The often overlooked aspect of the Snowden affair is the role of media in reporting about or deferring to government activities. What are your guiding principles when weighing in on this topic? So we have both the media side of it as well as the privacy and security side of it.
For me, I mean, the number one issue is constitutional liberty. And that is the core issue here. And of course, that guides all my deliberations in this area. The Fourth Amendment protects one against unreasonable search and seizure. That's what it says. We have a federal government that is out there doing things that are in clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. That's why, you know, like him or not, that's why Snowden claims he did what he did, and I believe him. I think he really felt there were significant constitutional violations going on, and he felt that this was the only way to out the system and help protect us from tyranny. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, made the comment that what's going on with the United States with the NSA is as bad as the Stasi, if not worse. I think she actually said it was worse than the Stasi.
Considering they spied on her cell phone.
Yeah, no, she was upset about that. There's no doubt. But think about it. We have a national security agency that probably, and this is not just Snowden as a whistleblower, but this is multiple whistleblowers, are saying that virtually all digital communications in the country are recorded. That means all cellular traffic. Now, that doesn't mean that we've got, you know, 15,000 analysts listening to everything. I do believe, and again, this is based upon whistleblowers, not just Snowden, that there are a lot of people under surveillance in this country that is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. I think that the recording of conversations that we have a reasonable expectation of privacy in is what, you know, the Fourth Amendment was intended to protect us against. But it's not just that. It's not just your cell traffic. It's what you do on the internet. You know, Prism is a program that has been outed by the whistleblowers that apparently tracks everything that you do on the internet. Again, I'm not suggesting that we have tens of thousands of analysts reviewing everything, but that's not the point. On occasion, when I talk about this, because this is a top-tier issue for me, occasionally when I hear on the trail as well, I'm not really worried about that. Joe, I'm not doing anything wrong. That's not the point. The point is that you basically vested in government all-knowing power, almost, omniscience, where they know everything that's going on. And you can even go to the admissions of the intelligence agencies and reach this point. The admissions of the intelligence agencies was that they're capturing all the metadata from phones, and that includes locational data, that includes who you're talking to, the length of the call. So the government knows pretty much how you think if they choose to target you by looking at what you're doing on the internet, your sources of information. You know, Americans now get over 50% get their news inputs of information from the internet. They know who your circle of influence is because they know who you're talking to. They know where you're at. And they even know the content of your conversation if they decide to gain access to it.
Yeah, so coming back to this idea of that balance of being able to protect U.S. interest, I mean, that's what the federal government uses that justification a lot of the time. So where is that balance? And especially if you were in Washington, what would you do to really establish that balance between both privacy and security?
I think it's first important to note that the lack of terrorism in this country is not a consequence of the surveillance state. There is not really any good indicator that it's prevented terrorism. But even if it did prevent some degree of terrorism, the issue is that we have tools at our resource, at our availability, that aren't being utilized to secure the country. And, you know, we've heard a lot about the problem with the children that have come across the border and the amnesty issue, the illegals in this country. The fact is that we have a country that really doesn't, at least at the upper levels, doesn't seem to care much about security. I mean, they're leaving a porous border in the South. If you actually wanted to make sure that we protected the security, it doesn't mean that we suddenly had to violate the Constitution. We use the tools that we have. There are countries that have far less wealth than we have, that have far less technological ability that we have, that have secured their borders. I mean, I've been to Israel a couple of times over the last several years. Israel has been able to secure the areas that it once secured, and it's done so at a cost that this country could certainly undertake.
The current national news or current world news with Israel at the moment wouldn't say that their borders aren't necessarily secure, considering right now a lot of the groundwork in Gaza is securing their borders.
I don't think that's an accurate statement. What they're facing right now are rockets that are being fired from Gaza. That there have been very minimal cross-border crossings. There have been some, but very, very limited. They certainly have not had millions come across their border like we have. They've had maybe tens, maybe several dozen. Their issue is now the rocket fire that's coming out of Gaza, and certainly if one of our neighbors were doing that, there would be ways to address that. But what I'm talking about is securing the border, and it's something that Israel has done very effectively.
Are you talking specifically about our border with Mexico, or are you also, I mean, looking towards Canada?
The real issue borders? Yeah, the real issue right now is that the poorest border in the South is the problem. We have all sorts of OTMs other than Mexicans that are coming across. There are documented cases of terrorists coming across our border, documented cases of Chinese nationals coming across our border. What my point is that those that use the excuse, it's the security of the nation, that's why we have to violate the Constitution, it's hogwash. It's hogwash. If they really wanted to secure this country, they would secure the borders, and they aren't. And that reflects they aren't acting in the national interest of the country.
Do you have any prospective ideas on how to do that, on how to move that forward?
Make sure that you've got an impassable border. I mean, go down in the South and look at the barbed wire fences that they've got there. I mean, it's ridiculous.
In what sense are you talking about building a wall, or how are you saying?
Well, we have some areas that are fairly impassable. I've been down to Mexico a number of times. My daughter, actually, who's married to a Mexican national, lives in Mexico. She's with Youth with a Mission, which is a missionary group down there. I go down to Mexico all the time. Where you pass through in San Diego, there's actually a secure border. If you go on, further east into Arizona, New Mexico, on toward Texas, there are a number of very porous areas where there's almost free passage that takes place. I mean, there are some areas in Arizona right now that are so overrun by illegals that the federal government has posted signs on land warning people to stay out of those areas. I think it's an atrocious case when the president stands up and says, well, we got to devote $5 billion to detention facilities, when, you could expend that much money and further secure the border. Or, for example, you could reunite the families of these children that come to America by buying first-class tickets and send them back to their Central American countries. To me, it's a world upside down. You've got a president, and it's not just Obama. I mean, this surveillance state started under the Bush administration, who's saying we want to secure the country but doesn't do the most fundamental thing in order to do it. And that reflects they really don't want to do it, or they're using this as an excuse to basically trample down our constitutional rights.
Thank you. And coming to our last question, we've touched on this a bit as well, this one with the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court has recently taken stands that seem to put corporations above individuals. In Alaska, that may be one aspect of the discussion of the role oil companies play in our owner state. How do you view corporations?
Well, I've got very serious concerns about Citizens United. I will tell you that I believe that the founders did not intend the First Amendment to limit political speech. That being said, we've got a real problem. We have corporations that are involving themselves in elections, some of which are multinational corporations. Money's fungible. You know, if it comes from a foreign source and goes into a corporation that's involved in an election, we effectively have foreign funding of domestic elections. And I have yet to even, and I come from, you know, those that...
Are you referring to super PACs, the money that's coming into super PACs, or...?
Well, Citizens United basically permitted corporate involvement in campaigns. Mm-hmm. Generally, it's through super PACs in which this happens. But there's lots of money that's coming into American elections. Of course, we saw kind of the first strike in 2010 with that, where many times that money is coming from sources that are not from domestic origin. If you have, again, an entity that's involved as a multinational corporation, how can you say that you've actually not had foreign funding of election? You can't do that. There's a problem with anonymity, where you basically have a corporation to shield evidence of who's involved in it. But I think one of the more troubling things about this is that many of these corporations are involved up to their necks, basically, with the federal government and the crony capitalist state. basically involved in elections because of the fact that the federal government is going to give them something as a result. So, for example, going back a few years in Alaska, where we had a number of federal contractors who were intimately involved in the race here in Alaska that definitely had a vested interest in the outcome because they were expected to continue to receive the federal money that they had invested in that race to get a particular result. Again, I don't think the founders intended the federal government through crony capitalists to fund campaigns. So there are some major issues.
Even just coming away from the campaign part of it, even right. just here locally with Prop 1 or Senate Bill 21, how do you think that that factors into this idea that corporations with Citizens United, that money equals free speech?
Well, again, I want to make it clear, I don't think the First Amendment ever intended to limit your speech. In other words, as an individual, if you've got $1 million, you should, as that individual, be able to spend $1 million on an election. We want to know who you are. I mean, you shouldn't be able to hide behind some anonymous organization. We certainly don't think, I don't believe, that somebody that's trying to influence the outcome of elections, particularly an individual that has a vested interest in that, should be able to be shielded by some sort of anonymous entity. But the corporate entity, I don't think you see that anywhere in the U.S. Constitution. It's used as a vehicle for business. But to suggest that the Bill of Rights was created to protect corporations, it confounds me. And I know that I'm in the minority, perhaps, amongst those in the Republican Party. But this is a huge issue. Now, Milton Friedman made an interesting statement, and that is that if you get business, and this is a paraphrase, but if you get business or government, I'm sorry, out of business, then business will get away from D.C. In other words, if the government stops interfering, regulating, creating barriers to entrance, in fact, a lot of these corporations get involved not because they get money from the federal government as federal contractors, but because they get regulations passed that freeze out competition. It's not the free enterprise system when government is harnessed for corporate benefit. Not at all.
So could you – I'm coming back to the Hobby Lobby case
sure.
that just came out. Could that be interpreted the same way, that corporate interest is trumping personal and private decisions?
You know, that's a very interesting case, and I'm glad you brought that out, because this reflects, again, this is the paradox with this, is that we have individuals that operate through businesses, for example. And in the Hobby Lobby case, you've got a very closely held corporation. Perhaps that's the distinction, where you have people that have deeply held religious conviction. I mean, obviously, the owner's Hobby Lobby, multi-billion-dollar business, but it's a family-owned business. And
closely held, I mean, that closely held is a distinction that is five people or less control 50% of a company. And there's a lot of companies that fall into that closely held distinction.
Well, I think the key is making sure that you actually have individuals that you can identify that are part of those businesses, that you know who they are, where you don't have this situation where you've got these multinational corporations that in many, many cases, you have absolutely no idea who the contributors are, where the income sources are. You don't know whether it's foreign. You don't know where it's domestic. May actually, like, for example, a number of the corporations actually have greater income and revenue than some countries do. Hobby Lobby is clearly a company that started from the beginning, family-owned, family-controlled, where you have people that have firmly held beliefs consistently reflected throughout the course of time that they've owned that business. And basically, the federal government came in and said, you will do X, Y, and Z, even if it violates your religious freedoms, even though it violates your free exercise. And that runs completely counter to the whole American experiment of compelling people to act in a way that violates conscience. And we've seen that not just in Hobby Lobby.
But that's also a for-profit corporation, because there is a distinction for nonprofits and for, like, religious-affiliated hospitals and things, that they have that out.
I think that's a distinction without meaning. And, you know, we can even talk about, you know, for example, whether there ought to be limits on nonprofits and political speech. I don't think there should be. I mean, the whole course of this country's, or for example, the American Revolution, how did it start? The Black Robe Regiment. Largely churches were involved in the start of the revolution. And very, very politically active religious communities that influenced basically leadership in government. Because yeah, that was kind of the fabric of society. And it wasn't until the Johnson Amendment in the 1960s that really went through without any debate where there were limits. And now you have, for example, I think there are 1,500 churches almost every year that do what's called Pulpit Freedom Sunday, where pastors actually stand up in sermon, endorse a candidate, they videotape it, they send it to the IRS, and they say, go after us. And so far, the IRS has not gone after one because the IRS recognizes that the First Amendment was not intended to limit that kind of speech, religious speech, that does have political implications. So I think the guiding principle, again, it's the Constitution in this issue, too.
But it's also, I mean, it's an access issue for those individual women, because then, I mean, it's back to that privacy versus a for-profit corporation being able to make those decisions for those women and those families.
I think that you need to understand what Hobby Lobby's position was in this. Hobby Lobby said, look, we own this business. We built this business. So they didn't agree with Obama that others built that business. They felt they had built that business, and I tend to agree with them. People chose to work at that business knowing that it was a Christian-owned business. Their position was, look, you, the government, cannot force us to provide abortifacients to our workers. This was not a contraception case. This was a case in which Hobby Lobby said, we will not provide the tools by which innocent life is extinguished. And that was a deeply held religious belief that they had. They were committed to it, so much so that they were willing to close the doors of the business rather than comply with something that they believe was clearly unconstitutional, but more importantly, clearly a violation of conscience.
Thank you very much. We've come to the end of our time. I think we had a lot of great conversations, got into a lot of deep issues. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, for being here in the studio. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Miller.
Bye-bye.